October is Breast Cancer Awareness Month, it's National Diabetes Month, and it's also Domestic Violence Awareness Month. The U.S. Department of Justice defines domestic violence as a pattern of abusive behavior in any relationship that is used by one partner to gain or maintain power and control over another intimate partner. Once a person becomes a victim of domestic violence, it can be difficult for them to get the help they need.
I met my husband while I was in college, and we got married about 2 years after college, and everything was exciting before then to me. But once we got married, I guess I would say closer to the time that we got married, that's when I started to notice things. In retrospect, I see, you know, there were a lot of red flags.
Erica is a 30-something mother of two. She sat down with me on Monday to talk to me about her experience as a victim of domestic violence. Erica received counseling at a local nonprofit we reached out to. She agreed to speak with me as long as I only used her first name to protect her privacy.
For me, it wasn't a daily, you know, situation where he was constantly physically abusing me, but there was a lot of, you know, like mental abuse going on and financial, where he controlled all of our finances and I didn't have, you know, I would have to ask just to go get groceries or just to do anything. I had to get his permission.
Domestic violence can be physical, sexual, emotional, economic, or psychological. Like Erica, many people don't know that they are victims until a family member or a loved one intervenes.
It actually, the worst time, I guess I would say, of physical violence, I only left for a week. I actually still stayed. It took my parents stepping in. I came down for a friend's wedding and being able to get outside the situation because I was isolated. I wasn't around family. I was, you know, just around his family and I was just around my husband. And so it took me getting outside of the situation to understand how serious it was what I was in.
Another factor that empowered Erica to seek help was her children.
My daughter and my son, they weren't even five by the time this stuff happened. But at the same time, your children can see it. To me, I always thought, no, they don't know what's going on. Your children know, you know, and it's something that's going to impact them and very well determine the type of relationships that they have.
Erica found solace and education at the Coastal Women's Shelter, which serves Craven, Jones, and Pamlico counties and reaches out to victims of domestic violence. Martha Hardison is the executive director.
The Coastal Women's Shelter provides counseling services on individual basis, on one-to-one, but it also has monthly support groups that is held twice a month for those that are victims of domestic violence, and they are held in all three counties.
The shelter also provides a 24-hour crisis line, court advocacy, transportation, and employment resources. They also operate a safe house where victims can stay at a secret location until they get back on their feet.
We actually shelter those women and children that are on the run, that need safety. We actually provide the housing, education, and let them stay with us from 60 to 90 days so that they can help to rebuild their lives.
The Coastal Women's Shelter is primarily funded by state and federal grants, as well as churches, other nonprofits, and fundraising events. The shelter also runs Helping Hands Boutique in James City to help generate funds. In 2011, the agency sheltered 648 women and children. Through counseling services and referrals, the Coastal Women's Shelter estimated it served over 5,000 people. Executive Director Hardison says a person may come to the shelter multiple times to receive services.
Statistics report that sometimes it takes 7 and 8 times before an individual makes the final break from their abuser. And we try to continue to support them in their efforts to be strong enough and to be self-sufficient to make that move.
Unfortunately, not all domestic violence victims escape their abuser. According to the North Carolina Department of Justice, state and local law enforcement reported 106 total homicides in 2011 related to domestic violence. About 18% of those incidents occurred in eastern North Carolina. Compiling statistics can be difficult because domestic violence cases often go unreported. Still, Hardison says there has been a surge in domestic violence so far this year in eastern North Carolina.
I think because of the economy today, because of the stress, because of the job market, these kinds of things that bear very heavily on the family, deployment, those kinds of things, that we're seeing an increase in domestic violence in families in our area.
The Coastal Women's Shelter targets females specifically because in 85% of domestic violence cases, men are the abusers. However, males can be victims too. Speaking as a survivor of domestic violence, Erica urges anyone to get help if they are being controlled or abused.
Like, no one has the right to abuse you. No one has the right, whether it's financially, whether it's mentally, no type of abuse does a person deserve. But it's really finding that strength within to know that you don't deserve that. And that's what it took for me, because even leaving, you know, I still struggle with wanting to go back to that situation. But we have to love ourselves enough to know that it's not okay, no matter whether it's a man or a woman, it's not okay. And you have to really find that strength. And there are so many resources out to help you.
If you or someone you know is a victim of domestic violence, you can call and get counseling through the National Domestic Violence Hotline at 1-800-799-7233. You can find more information on the Coastal Women's Shelter at www.coastalwomenshelter.org. I'm Jared Brumbaugh. This is the Downeast Journal. As the 225th anniversary of the signing of the U.S. Constitution passes, we think of the Bill of Rights, most notably Amendment 1, freedom of speech or freedom of the press, and Amendment 2, the right of people to keep and bear arms. L.C. Morris has this report on gun control laws in North Carolina.
For civilians, the right to bear arms has and will continue to be a contentious topic, as a growing number of organizations call for more gun control laws. Lad Everett is the communications director for the Coalition to Stop Gun Violence.
It's really bad. I think the important point to understand here is that there is no other democracy on the face of the earth that endures the type of gruesome daily shootings that we see here in the United States. We are the aberration. There is no other free nation on the face of the earth that has failed to address this problem like we have failed.
The Coalition to Stop Gun Violence, or CSGV, seeks to secure freedom from gun violence through research, strategic engagement, and effective policy advocacy.
The short answer is we simply don't have many laws in place.
Gun control is any law, policy, practice, or proposal designed to restrict or limit the possession, production, importation, shipment, sale, and/or use of guns or other firearms by private citizens. Most commonly, the guns in question are personal firearms, typically handguns and long guns.
When you look at the nation on a federal level, or if you look at North Carolina specifically, you know, I think what's important to understand is that there are really two parallel streams of gun commerce that are happening around us on a daily basis. When we think of buying a gun, most of us tend to think of going into a gun store, right? You walk into Bob's Guns, and, you know, Bob is a federally licensed firearms dealer. And when you go in, you undergo that instant computer check. And if you pass that check, you then get your gun. That's one way to buy a gun in this country. But in your own state, for example, North Carolina, and about 40 or more other states, you can buy a gun through a private sale, where a private individual, a private firearm seller, is legally allowed to sell you that gun without conducting any background check or maintaining any paper record of that sale.
Purchasing a legal firearm from a licensed dealer means adhering to federal and state requirements, which include a background check. However, a person-to-person sale can be made with no type of background check at all. Even with certain background checks in place, such as searching for evidence of mental commitment, wanted persons, or domestic violence offenders, Everett says the information is not detailed enough.
Number one, the screening is incredibly narrow. It's all it is an instant computer check. It is not a background investigation. It is something that is over in a matter of minutes. And if the databases that are checked do not find a disqualifying record, all the gun dealer would see is approve or deny on a computer screen. They're not seeing anything about your background. The FBI NICS database, which is supposed to maintain disqualifying records from around the states, is missing millions of records that the states have yet to submit to it. So very often, people who should be prohibited are being approved through this system.
Recent high-profile shootings, such as the July 2012 Batman movie massacre in Colorado, bring the issue of mental competency to the forefront of the gun control issue.
the criteria for being prohibited based on mental health reasons is very narrow. The only two categories of Americans for mental health reasons who would be prohibited from buying guns are those who have been involuntarily committed, forced to go into a mental institution, or those who have been formally adjudicated by a court either as mental incompetence or as a threat to themselves or others. In the universe of severely mentally ill Americans, very, very few fall into one of those two narrow categories. And if you do not, you can legally stockpile all the guns you want. And again, that gun dealer sees nothing about your background. When James Holmes, for example, or Jared Loughner or Sung-hee Cho, when these mentally ill mass shooters went in and legally bought guns, some of them on multiple occasions, the dealer saw absolutely nothing about their mental health history. All they saw was a blip on a screen that said approved.
In August of this year, white supremacist shooter and former Fort Bragg Army soldier Wade Michael Page went on a rampage at a Sikh temple in suburban Milwaukee, killing six people. According to the Fayetteville Observer, Page obtained five permits in North Carolina to purchase pistols in 2008. The North Carolina Rifle and Pistol Association requires all intended handgun recipients obtain a pistol purchase permit from the local sheriff at a cost of $5 per permit.
Well, I mean, for the most part, if you're talking about a semi-automatic firearm, which would be a firearm that basically fires one bullet with each pull of the trigger, those guns are wide open available on the civilian market. And you know, you could buy, for example, you mentioned, I think, an AK-47. You could buy semi-automatic AK-47s or AR-15s or virtually any other modern current battlefield rifle you could imagine through federally licensed dealers, or you could buy them through private sales without undergoing any background check at all. When you talk about weapons that fire with select fire, which means they can fire either on semi-automatic fire or through full automatic fire, which means when you squeeze that trigger down and hold it, it will continue to spray fire from the gun until you release the trigger. Those guns are regulated more strictly in the United States. You do need a special license.
Special interest groups, primarily in the United States, exert political pressure for and against legislation limiting the right to keep and bear arms. The largest pro-gun advocacy group is the National Rifle Association and its political wing, the NRA Institute for Legislative Action. The NRA has been described as one of the largest and most powerful political special interest groups in the United States.
So basically what the NRA is a bunch of right-wing conservative power players linked directly in with the gun industry. And their concern, they have two concerns, primary concerns. One is to profit from their very intimate and close ties with the gun industry. And when you look at the guys that run that organization, like Wayne LaPierre and Chris Cox, we're talking about millionaires here. Guys that are raking in well over $1 million every year from that profession. And their second interest is to essentially have their constituency serve as shock troops on a range of different right-wing causes.
Alan Gottlieb is the founder of the nation's largest and oldest tax-exempt nonprofit, the Second Amendment Foundation. The foundation has been a pioneer in innovative defense of the right to keep and bear arms through its publications, public education programs, and legal action. Gottlieb says there is a reason why politics plays a role. 80 million gun owners equal 80 million voters.
Well, the reason why the gun rights movement is so strong in this country and so politically active is the fact we have, you know, upwards of 80 million firearms owners across the country that want to protect their rights. And so when the other side, you know, comes out and talks about how there's an evil, powerful organization doing all this lobbying or gun manufacturers doing this lobbying, what they're not taking into effect is that 80 million gun owners vote, and that's what makes it a potent political force in this country. When 80 million people want to protect their rights and vote to protect those rights, politicians pay attention and consider, you know, what it might take to get reelected. And as a result, that's why the gun rights movement is so politically potent.
Gottlieb says the laws that are in place are good and tight, and agrees that there is room for improvement when it comes to mental competency and owning a firearm.
Well, the laws that are in place that determine if you can pass a background check or not are good, and they're pretty solid. The problem we have is that in cases of mental illness, sometimes those records are not getting into the database when people are attempting to buy firearms. And that's a problem that we have in the record keeping and law enforcement. It's not a reason to have new laws put in place. It's probably a reason to try and make sure the data is not corrupted. We also have in that data, lots of times people find out they're disqualified from buying a firearm, and they're really not. It's just their name is similar to somebody else's, and as a result, their rights get violated. So it works both ways. Sometimes wrong people are getting firearms that shouldn't be, and sometimes people who should be able to get them are denied the purchase. So I'd like to see the database cleaned up a little bit and kept more accurately, and that's something that the federal government and the states need to work on.
Cash and carry. No names. It's all legal. Everett says there's really no reason to file down a serial number on a firearm, as shown so many times on multiple police detective shows, as all the owner has to do is show a police report stating that the gun was stolen.
No paperwork, not a single sheet of paper. There is no paper trail whatsoever for law enforcement to follow if that gun changes hands and winds up at a crime scene. It is literally, and I would encourage your listeners, go to gun shows in North Carolina. You will see private sellers operating out of tables. You will see them wearing billboards on their bodies and carrying guns and selling them that way. They'll just be lingering about, and they will literally be doing cash and carry sales. They will be selling guns to people, in many cases where they won't even know the first names of the buyers, handing them guns for cash. That is it.
CSGV is comprised of 48 national organizations working to reduce gun violence.
The seller has no legal duty whatsoever to conduct a background check or to maintain any record of sale. Now, if as a federal agent or a state law enforcement agent, if you could prove that the private seller knew the buyer was a prohibited party, right, and he sold him the gun anyway, you could convict or you could indict that seller. But the problem is, if that person didn't have any duty to conduct a background check, how are they going to know if the person's a prohibited purchaser, right? And are they really going to admit to you if they knew that the person was a prohibited purchaser, let's say from the conversation that went on before the gun was sold? We need to realize this is totally unregulated. There are no regulations. It is a free-for-all.
For more information, you can visit their website at csgv.org. I'm L.C. Morris.
The Down East Journal is made possible by our members in partnership with Carolina Kidney and Vascular, offering a full range of nephrology and vascular services, including acute and chronic kidney disease diagnosis and treatment, plus minimally invasive endovascular therapy. Carolina Kidney and Vascular, Goldsboro, 919-580-9840. This is the Down East Journal. A film festival takes place this weekend to celebrate the life and legacy of actress Ava Gardner, a legendary movie star from the 50s, 60s, and 70s. It will also highlight her ties to Eastern North Carolina. Ford Parson has more.
Regarded today as one of the greatest film stars of the 20th century, actress Ava Gardner spent much of her young life right here in eastern North Carolina.
You look like din, Mother. How about you, Miss Phillips?
Thank you. We'll just sit here and wait until lunch is ready.
Miss Phillips, honey, I know you got a beef or two, but why don't you just relax with a little complimentary rum cocoa?
Save them for your friend, Mr. Shannon. I don't imbibe.
And have a little pot. I don't usually serve it to my guests. But you look like you need something special.
Ava Gardner was born on Christmas Eve 1922 in the small farm community of Grabtown, about 8 miles southeast of Smithfield. Ava was the youngest of seven children born to Jonas and Molly Baker Gardner. After the Gardners lost everything during the agricultural depression of the 1920s, they moved into the boarding house at the Brogdon School, where Ava's parents began work. Here, young Ava found many friends in the school's teachers and students. Doris Rollins Cannon is the author of Grabtown Girl, Ava Gardner's North Carolina Childhood and Her Enduring Ties to Home. Cannon has spent decades researching Ava Gardner's life.
Well, everybody just adored little Ava. She would entertain the teachers and their boyfriends on Sunday afternoon in the parlor. She was a real tomboy.
At the Brogdon School, Ava was never able to get the best roles in school plays.
Ava's voice was so soft it wouldn't reach beyond the first rows of the auditorium. Therefore, Ava had never had a good part in a school play.
When Ava was 12, the Johnston County School Board became unable to pay for the Gardners to continue living in the boarding house. The Gardners moved to Newport News, Virginia, where Ava's parents began work at another school boarding house. After Ava's father died in 1938, Ava and her mother moved to Rock Ridge in Wilson County, where they lived throughout Ava's teenage years. The dark-haired, exotic beauty continued to gain friends and participated in several beauty pageants, but experienced little success.
She was in a beauty contest in Rocky Mount at one time when she was a teenager and either came in third or didn't place at all.
She experienced a big break in the summer of 1939 when a man pretending to be a talent scout for MGM noticed her picture in a New York City photography studio owned by Ava's sister. The photos were sent to MGM, and after a successful screen test, Ava's film career began. Throughout Ava Gardner's hugely successful career, she appeared in many popular films such as Showboat, The Killers, and Mogumbo.
I could be pea green with jealousy and not hacked up any more than I am already. You know, this is no Sir Galahad who loves from afar. This is a two-legged boa constrictor.
Ava was in several relationships and marriages with famous actors and musicians, including Mickey Rooney, Artie Shaw, and Frank Sinatra. Those who were in close contact with the movie star say she at times battled alcohol abuse and had a fiery temper. In her book, Ava, My Story, she warns, "When I lose my temper, honey, you can't find it anyplace." During her 30-year career, Ava became close friends with fellow film star Gregory Peck. The two appeared in three films together, including the classic On the Beach.
Then I suppose that when the time has come to say it's been nice, Dwight Lionel.
The executive director of the Ava Gardner Museum in Smithfield, Todd Johnson, says Gardner and Peck remained friends throughout their lives.
When she died in 1990, the Pecks actually adopted her dog. She was an avid lover of corgis, and she had a little pet corgi named Morgan, and the Pecks took Morgan and also Ava's housekeeper and took them to Los Angeles, and Morgan died there and is buried in the Pecks' backyard in Los Angeles.
To celebrate Ava Gardner's life, career, and close connection with Eastern North Carolina, the Ava Gardner Museum in Smithfield is hosting the 8th annual Ava Gardner Festival. The 3-day event will focus on the relationship between Gardner and her co-star and friend Gregory Peck. The festival will include live auctions, exhibits, film screenings, and tours of Ava's home.
On Saturday, we'll have heritage tours, bus tours of Ava's birthplace, the teacherage in Brogdon where she grew up, and also her grave. She's buried here in Smithfield. We're showing movies, the Gregory Peck, Ava Gardner movies, The Great Sinner, Snows of Kilimanjaro, and On the Beach throughout the day on Saturday. It'll be a first-come, first-served basis for anyone who buys admission to the museum. And then on Sunday, we're going to be showing Gregory Peck's most well-known movie, which is To Kill a Mockingbird.
In addition to these events, Johnson says the Ava Gardner Festival will welcome a special guest.
Probably the most important thing that's going to happen that weekend is a visit by Ava's former maid who lives in Sacramento. She's written a book about her life with Ava. The title is Living with Miss G, and her name is Renee Jordan. She will be here that weekend.
The Ava Gardner Festival has been held annually for the past 7 years.
Last year, we had a great response. We focused on the Frank Sinatra connection last year, and we had, I'd say, 1,000 to 1,200 people who came to the museum that weekend.
The 2012 Ava Gardner Festival will take place this weekend at the Ava Gardner Museum at 325 East Market Street in Smithfield. For more information, visit the ENC events page at publicradioeast.org. I'm Ford Parson.
This is Ann Edwards, Horticulture Extension Agent, with this week's entry in the Garden Journal. You may remember a couple months ago, we talked about kudzu bugs, a new insect in North Carolina, somewhat oblong in shape, olive green in color with brown speckles, about the size of a ladybug. They were coming in large numbers and being found on beans, kudzu, wisteria, any other plant in those same family. Well, those bugs then moved into the field crops as the field crops became more prevalent in the area.
But now, as the days are getting shorter and the air is getting cooler, they're starting to move towards homes. What they're doing is looking for a place where they can spend the winter, protected. What you don't want is to have that place be your house, partly because they smell just ghastly. So, what are you looking for? The kudzu bugs are starting to congregate on light-colored surfaces, such as siding and eaves, right now in some areas. You can take care of them using pretty much any household insect spray with direct contact. What you can't do is control the bug by treating the outside of your house. That's probably going to produce very poor to only mediocre results. First of all, if you don't have proper equipment to apply an insecticide up high in the home where the bugs are likely to congregate, it's not going to do much good, and you certainly don't want to be spraying something up over your head that's going to come back down on you. Second, because the insects are still actively feeding, their movement out of the plants and onto the house will probably occur over several weeks, which means an application today of some sort of insecticide is not going to have any effect on the insects that get there next week. If you do decide to use an insecticide, be very, very careful to read the directions and follow them, particularly the directions for protecting you as you're applying the pesticide. Be sure you take away and cover objects like outdoor chairs, grills, swimming pools, and toys, as well as dog bowls and such. You don't want to be spraying onto those objects. Be careful when spraying near ponds and other bodies of water, as some insecticides are poisonous to fish. Again, remember that pesticides will have limited ability to stop the bugs from entering the home. The most important thing you can do is seal any gaps and openings, such as where plumbing and air conditioner lines enter the house. If there's no place for them to enter, they may congregate on the outside, but they won't come in. If insects do come inside, do avoid crushing them, because they might stain the surfaces where you crush them, and they certainly will smell. Vacuum them up and take the vacuum bag or the contents of your vacuum into a trash bag. Freeze that bag for several days. I know, that's disgusting, but you want to be sure you kill the insects that are inside. You can also drop the bugs into soapy water to kill them. If you simply dump the bag outdoors, they'll likely end up surviving and back inside your house. If you've got any kudzu around your neighborhood, it's a good time to get rid of it to avoid these in future years. Sadly, wisteria, you might want to consider the same thing if you're finding you have a big kudzu bug infestation. If you aren't seeing any kudzu bugs yet, wait and see. Maybe they're not going to become a problem in your neighborhood. If you've got an unusual looking bug that's square in the back and round in the front and spotted brown and olive, well, you might have the kudzu bug, and you might want to be starting to look for areas around your house to close up before they come in to spend the fall with you. And I'll talk to you in next week's entry in the Garden Journal.
Thank you for listening to the Downey's Journal today. If you have questions, comments, or ideas for features, you can drop us a line at the NewsHound link found on the homepage. And don't forget, you can also listen to archived editions of the Downey's Journal. That's all at publicradioeast.org.